pleasure to be here, and this is, of course, the last session of the conference, or the last presentation-type session. So as I was commenting beforehand, those of you who are here, I know you really want to be here, so I really appreciate that. We're going to do some housekeeping first before we get started. This is the presentation page for this presentation. I know LC will, or LX will have all the archives after, but I also keep my own archive page of my own presentations. So later on, if you're looking for the slides or the audio or the video or the you'll be able to find it there on my website. And you'll notice the slides are preloaded, so if you're following along at home and you're in Adobe Connect and the words are that big on the slide, you can go there and look at the slides now. And it's a nice, neat slideshow. Next thing, and this is the part that's fun. Well, that's fun. This is more fun. And we're back then. And it's not just the ordinary Twitter LC13 feed or LC2013 feed, but it's also the local back channel. So here it is. He says, what fun is a conference and a conference presentation? If you can't put the date now up on the screen, the hands are good. So I invite you to do this. I can read it here as well. Ironically, I have to look back to see my own slides, but your comments will be right front and center. You can either tweet using the hashtag, as we pick up those, or you can go to dance.ca/chat, and you'll get a nice comment window like it shows there, and you can comment without having to log into Twitter. So for those of you who are Twitter holdouts, you're finally invited to the party. Again, those of you who are not with us in person, but here in the ether, you also are able to participate in the conversation, either of those two means. And what's pretty cool is, if you're sitting there in Addis Ababa and you make a comment, the people here in Manningham will see it. The way it works is, once every 10 seconds, a new comment will come up. I'm going to break up from time to time reading this, I'm sure. Okay, so that's the setup. Do that. It's more fun. I've got slides, I've got a talk, I've got things I'm going to say. I don't really feel bound by that presentation. I mean, I'll do it if I have to. It's okay. I'm pretty bound, so I'll probably get through all the slides even in more order. But, I'm not going to feel constrained to talk about that if there's an objection, a comment, whatever. Try and keep them clean. Remember, you're broadcasting on Twitter, worldwide network, which has content. Well, you're live here too, so be clean. So, without further ado, the talks, and I look forward to your comments. And is that the, that must be the, that would get very recursive if I clicked it. But these links, on my backside, if you go to dance.ca, there's a putting pictures, HTML, whatever you want. So if you have a funny picture you want to put up, like a wild cat or whatever, I encourage you to speak in wild cats. And I can also click on your Twitter, the links, if you put your link on your Twitter, and get Twitter. And be warned, if you put a link on that, click on it. Because I like random events in my talks. So, as was mentioned in the introduction, I was here, well, actually I was in Manchester, but I was at at sea in 2005, and I had a wonderful time. I was invited then, as I am now, and so I have been invited back, which may have been a horrible mistake, but maybe not a thing. I prefer to go with the latter. And it's interesting because, it's interesting because they brought me to tonight's conference I'm not sure exactly what it was called, but it was like a special topical speaker. And so my topic that I was investigating was the series of things I did was collaboration, which was, I find interesting and ironic because I don't really believe in collaboration properly so-called, and that came out at the conference. It's interesting many years later to see the reactions from my talk and the few of them that you presented to me this week, which is fascinating to me. One person remembered this thing that I said. I said, how many of you would be here if you were not being paid by your employer? The idea here is that what we sometimes depict as natural, freely chosen collaboration is not necessarily the case, and that there have been external means of persuasion applied. Another thing that was raised, and this was in a paper blog post, from Jenny McNess, collaboration is the joining together of things that do not naturally want to be joined. There's another thing I said in Manchester in 2005, and as she says, there's an audible sucking in of breath when I said that, which is, of course, not exactly counter to the theme of the conference. I notice I can get away with saying that now, there's no audible sucking of breath, so that's good. So, I'm going to pick up where I left off in 2005, without interruption, and let's look at where collaboration has gone since then, and in the concept of collaboration, that's a Google trend, and it runs from 2005 to now, and as you can see, it's on a steady downhill slide. But we also have the alternative concept, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about that alternative concept in this talk. It's something that I wasn't really able to draw out as much as I wanted to in 2005. It just hadn't really occurred to me that way. But now, as a keynote sermon, yes, it has. I can say for sure that the keynote is starting. And that's the concept of cooperation. And I've got my colors backwards. How annoying is that? So, I've been looking at this all along, thinking cooperation is the one that started high, started low, went high, and low. They're pretty much one equal, right? Cooperation, collaboration. But they're two distinct concepts. And I'm going to talk a bit today about how these concepts are distinct, and how and why I favor cooperation as opposed to collaboration. That's kind of a sub-theme to what I'm talking about. Some other things happened in the interim between 2005 and now, and a lot of that had to do with networks. And when we look at Google Trends, networks killed collaboration and cooperation. Just destroyed them. And look at the distribution by region. I think we were on to something in Canada. Canada is the nexus, the world nexus for network talk. I find that very interesting. Darren's need to moderate to monitor the tweets. No, I don't. So, Twitter moderator. Twitter pleasures. I might even have a click on that. So, you may have seen this table or this chart before. I mean, there's networks and there's networks, right? Random events welcome. That's somebody typing it in. That's great. That's an anonymous random comment typed into. I just be all right, shouldn't we? I actually do have this planned one tomorrow. I guess it would have been a bit much for this, but of course, I'd like to write to Kimiko, right? And I've got this chat system, and I can have people comment on it. I can have my computer program randomly insert comments of its own throughout the talk, right? So they're not actually sent in by people, they're just chosen from the pool. Or maybe an interesting search engine or something that popped into it. Or maybe I could just have it randomly do links. So as people are commenting, it finds a website that has something to do with that, like a top thing at the stream. That would be cool. Anyway, that's where I've typed this. Anyhow, on the left, we have these networks that are centralized. And in fact, network looks a lot like a classroom. It's no accident. And networks over time, I guess, have gradually become less centralized and more distributed. Now, these networks have different properties. A network that is centralized, for example, will be much less stable than a network that is decentralized. Consider, for example, our friend Ebola virus, speaking of cultures. If a person out there gets the Ebola virus, it's just 2 hops before everybody in the network gets the Ebola virus. But if you have a distributed network, if one person gets the Ebola virus, it might be 5 or 6 hops before everybody gets it. This creates a bit of a delay, right? And this delay, in many ways, makes the network more resilient and more adaptable. So, we have some networks that are less resilient, others that are more. Some that are susceptible to bad cultures, if you will, and others that are not. This is how life classify them. I'm sure I'm not the only one who would classify them this way. Just to remind me, my standard aside, everything I say in this talk or in any talk ever has been said by somebody else before better than me. But this is the way I remember it now, so that's how I'm saying. So here's the division. The collaborative kind of networks, and yes, I do harken back to a lot talking about collaboration, resemble more these centralized networks. And I've put two kinds of centralized networks in, and I want to draw your attention to them. On the left is the classic scatter-shaped network. You might think about it in our mind as the dictatorship or the classroom, same thing, right? Because you have the one very influential node in the center, if that node fails, every other node in the network gets it. Then we have a slightly less centralized kind of network there, and it's known as, oh, let's see, turn off. Okay, stop, you go away now. Oops. I should be careful because I told my manager that I'd be available on Skype. But not during the talk. So, in that network to the right, it's still kind of a star network, but it's what we call a hub and spoke, where you still have a central node, you see it at the center, but the responsibility has been distributed a bit. And that's your class of hierarchy. And as an aside, so many times I see that hierarchy presented as a network, but it isn't, it's a hierarchy. It's not really a network. Well, it is a network, but it's not one of the most distributed kind of networks that I'm after. That would be the cooperative kind of network. And you can see in the cooperative network, it's much more peer-to-peer. The distribution of links per node is more or less the same. Every node in this one here has 2 or 3. When you have networks like that, as I said, they tend to be more robust. The power of any individual is not extremely greater than any other individual. And then we have the other kind of networks, which I've classified here as competitive. And you sort of want to to draw, almost engraving in your mind, right? Collaborative is everybody's on the same page, right? Cooperative, people are kind of doing their own thing, but they're all, you know, they're connected to other people. They're not, and then competitive, they're just doing their own thing, reading Ayn Rand and doing whatever, right? Interestingly, a network like this is functionally the same as a network where everybody is connected to everybody. Either case is a kind of chaos. One is a chaos of silence, the other is a chaos of noise. What we're after in a network is that sweet spot somewhere between nobody's connected and everybody's connected. So there's going to be a sweet spot where each of us has more or less the same number of connections to everybody else and a reasonable number of connections that we can cope with. You can see why we call it the collaborative networks. People can point to them and say, "Wait, but they work, right?" So, the Star Network, the trains ran on time, more or less. Hierarchies work if you ever want to get things done. Well, yeah, because they're better than nobody's connected and everybody's connected, right? They're not at the base of total uselessness. I'm creating terms as I go here. So, the end, that's the base of total uselessness. And then, you get the levels of connection of usefulness. So they're kind of here on this slope. But what I want to be is at the top. I want to be at the sweet spot of connectivity, the distributed kind of network thing. Stephen Hines and keynote speech around series, 2013 conference. Again, as an aside, I've set the speed of these things to one message every 10 seconds. That accords with the previously tweeted 6 tweets per minute. Okay, that adds up, right? I can change the speed of these if I need to. So if I'm lagging behind on the tweets, someone on the messages, somebody give me a shout on the speed of mine, but I don't think I need to. I don't seem to need to. Collaboration is the suspension of hostilities in pursuit of funding. It's just in this side of competition, isn't it? So, great to have a disruptive speaker. Thank you. So we leave a little discomforted but entertained. I'm not sure if I can entertain you, but I can leave you discomforted if I can read. So, you guys have spent the last 3 days, as have I, because I've been here for the duration of the conference. I haven't seen everything, but who has? Exploring all aspects of cultures of learning, and especially some of the things that stood out for me, where the digital literacy things, the open culture things, lots of stuff on MOOCs, so much stuff on MOOCs, and so on. Let's think about this theme for just a second. And because it's a theme that represents this kind of management view where somebody will make something happen. This is a theme we'll come back to a few times. All right. So the theme of the conference is building new cultures of learning. And when I looked at that, first thing I thought was, aside from, oh, it'd be nice to remind you that, I thought, that's a category error. Category error is a concept described at length by a philosopher called Gilbert Ryle. He's a behaviorist, but don't hold that against him. And what it is the attribution of a property appropriate to one category to entities of another category. And the example he gives is of school spirit. And our educators here. So we can get concept of school spirit. And somebody from another land comes to his university and says to Gilbert Ryle, "Well, I see the gymnasium, I see the arts building, I see the library, I see the administration building, but I don't see the school spirit anywhere." And Ryle says, "Well, it's behind science B." it's not the same sort of thing as one of the buildings on campus or one of the instructors or students on campus. School spirit is what we might call an emergent property. It results, or it exists, as a result of the sum total of all of the entities and all of the behaviors on the campus. So school spirit resides a bit in the sculpture of the room that everybody paints in the spring. It resides a bit in Forest Week. It resides a bit in the sports teams, the academic excellence team, the Nobel Prize winners, or whatever.
Well, the mixing metaphors badly, but in the hopes of getting a localized picture into the culture. Beyond examining the needs and the careers from the buildings and the students, what can we say of the course? What can we say of the culture of learning as a whole? And related how many have left early. I can tell you exactly how many people have left early because yesterday this audience was sick. I'll do the math. And very much a few points from the early environment. The MOOC. This is our effort. And by our, I mean myself and George Simmons and Dave Kinney and Leo Tom. And Ron Long and there's a whole bunch of people, many people in the show. And people on this side of the Atlantic, who's well most of the other side now, admitting that using the observation of the back channels and causing it to on the screen yet, which would seem to be the new tomorrow. All right. The point about me having this is the milk panel is that I'm 20 pounds. I'm 10 fish from that. And then I'm going to be this one. I do that with some things to turn off the other things. So, all right. So, I'm supposed to lay it to. I really should be doing it for so what the MOOC was, and I'm talking about the original MOOC that George Simmons and Alan Gould and others created, were really efforts to put into practice this stuff you're talking about now. All this stuff I just said about networks, which seems to sort of pull on all things you're messing with, find it practical physical instantiation in the form of a MOOC. What we're trying to do in the MOOC is move away from that hierarchical, star-shaped kind of network, not all the way over to chaos, because that would be absurd, but to find that sweet spot of emergence. That is the design principle behind the MOOC. That's why I think it can't be abandoned since, but that's what we were building. The MOOC has changed a bit in our perception, and it really struck me how much it changed when I talked to such more yesterday, and all the conversations that were online and the links were at the bottom of the slide. And I'm not sure if it actually came out in the conversation or not, but at some point in our talk, he talked about whether the MOOC would be a good way to approach the problem is 7 million students in the country needing math remediation. And I hummed and I hummed. And because to me, that wasn't the purpose of the MOOC. To me, the purpose of the MOOC wasn't to take some piece of content that you really, really want people to have and give it to them. That's a model, of course, that we're trying to move away from. And I talked a bit more about that. And so we went back and forth a bit on it. And, he ultimately agreed that really the MOOCs would be appropriate for about 750,000 cosmos here, that we're actually seeking to learn and become remediated in our thoughts. So that actually, yeah, right? People seeking out mass remediation on their own, taking that step now, the land in the MOOC is probably landed in the right place. But what that leaves lingering in my mind is what about the rest? Now, if we're talking about a learning culture, in some important sense, we're talking about all 7 million and not the 750,000 people whose self-perception of their needs have been translated to correspond with our own perception of their needs. One of the words in the text is really enlightenment. This is so inclusive. I'm going to try to click on this. What you thought? Oh, this is how I lose in final night. Okay. So, and this is a challenge. It really is. It's a serious challenge. It's a serious challenge that Paul puts in there. It's a challenge across the board for anybody who would purport to do education using the MOOC. And there's all kinds of questions about the MOOC right now. How will you be able to do this? What will be the outcomes of that, etc., etc.? I'll talk about some of that. But I want to talk about this conference, too. And because this conference isn't about MOOCs, even though that may be relevant here, this conference is about culture, and this conference is about change. And one of the very first things I heard about at this conference was Matthew Owens and the notion, and I don't know if I can get it right, the notion of students as change agents is a relatively new concept. Okay, didn't do the awesome, really well, but thanks, maybe. I haven't been into a single book session. That's kind of like being blind, who sailed across the entire Pacific Ocean in a tiny boat and didn't hit a single island. And that comment struck me as, well, wrong, because, you know, we've thought of students as change agents since forever, haven't we? Education to the students, and then, I think it's a registry, full registration form or something. I looked on Google and I found hundreds and hundreds of students in the bombing, in the streets, trying to end wars, trying to stop the draft, trying to get stipends paid to students, all kinds of things. But we agreed that actually what's new is the idea that we would allow them to make change. And that seems to be the new concept. And that leads us to Rachel Winston, who gave us that what I thought was a very clear, even articulate talk about the role that students can and should play in their own education. How do you build a culture when they're learning out of books? This is what's really not good is I have on my phone an application that lets me listen to old time radio. And the last few days, I've been listening to Gretchen do About Your Life. And it's just fascinating. It really wraps interviews with the contestants. And those people are most of the show. But they'll say something, and just off the top of the show, just coming up on Zoom. And it's really scary. And so I got that really in the back of my head. And now I'm looking at these, out of the middle of nowhere comments, and my first reaction is to be good from there, so it's just not good. Anyway, so she says, and she's right, students should be active participants in learning courses. But when you look at the literature, she says, and she's right, what you see most often there's some kind of definition of student participation, personalization, engagement, whatever it is, them making decisions about the timing of their courses, the amount of effort they're putting into their courses, things like that. But there's a completely different sense of participation in these courses, and that's one where students are involved and empowered to shape the learning environment itself. And in the middle, is very much what we were trying to build in the MOOC. The very first thing we did when we built the first MOOC is we set up a wiki and we invited everybody who's interested in the course to come and change what we thought the course should be. Come and shape the course for themselves. And not very many of them did that, but they could have. And when I define engagement in the course, he asked, because it's a work engineer, well, maybe, but more, it's to offer an alternative to that consumer manner of education. An alternative to that manner of education, which is based on the hierarchy, based on the structure of one node in the center, feeding wisdom to everybody else. So, when I'm listening to her talk, what you hear is, of course, influenced so much by your previous mindset and what you hear in the English. So when I hear her talk, what I was hearing is her saying, we want to be part of this network rather than merely passive recipients in the hierarchical kind of network. We want a society structured in a more distributed manner. And now that's getting kind of almost subversive, but that seems to be clear what she's saying. And what's new is we're counting again for the first time the possibility of letting people who are not authorities actually do that. What does this partnership look like? And to be honest, I prefer not to have the ice cream on the line screen back to the green stuff, but I didn't try to spend the fancy. People want to fall back into that habit where, I can kill it. I can kill it and then just go and do the thing and give you the same wisdom. But, it wouldn't be as good. Because the value, I'm still on the side, that's what I'm going to do. Oh, we're going along and I missed it. Oh, what is a wildcat? Someone didn't know, but you saw that. The wildcat is a picture, preferably of a cat, with an interesting and preferably funny thing in it. That's what they have. You can't build a culture of companions with your human beings, not dogs or dogs. That's another thing that's simple. We are not dogs. The case of the streets, of course, who's going to complain? What does this talk about? I was in the middle of my slide, but I'm done with it. I was a student journalist, so I worked for and was for the time the editor of a student newspaper called The Gauntlet. And we were members of something called the Canadian University Press. And the Canadian University Press had a much debated statement of principles that said, in effect, the purpose of the student press is to act as agents of social change. So it all came to a full circle point. And I thought, it would be just like full circle. And it's interesting because the way we achieved this, the way we associated it as student journalists in the 1980s in Canada, and they still do it to this day, they're still out there, recent social change, is that in Canada, our student newspapers are not owned by the administration, they are not owned by the student union, they are independent, they are owned by themselves. The people who create the newspapers and the students of that institution are the owners of it, and for the most part, they're entirely owned around democratically. athletes, basketball teams, student presidents, none of these people tell them how to run it. They run it themselves, completely autonomously. And it's a great thing. It's a fabulous thing. And for someone who participated in that learning experience for 5 years, while I was doing a philosophy degree, I then had to train more of a journalist in those 5 years than I did a philosopher. Certainly not philosophy. I got on the screen, hey, me too. So, a cultural learning, and for that matter, a cultural, a learning culture, is composed of, it's composed of much more than classes, and school, and subjects. Composed of, and I would say this over and over and over again, as long as I would keep it in, it was composed of the attitudes and qualities of a culture of experimentation, of curiosity, and in my case, especially, most especially, of quirkiness. The idea here is to take the experience and make it your own. You know, I'm just sort of thinking, I didn't put this in the file today, and I had to do it completely. But we take this concept today and transform that into the concept of the intern, where instead of running your own newspaper, everything from the business office to advertising to publication to distribution, you become somebody who gets coffee for somebody in an online magazine. So we change our understanding of what it means to be engaged in society. And this is why people make great things. We need to make a point of what engagement really is. So, yesterday, speaking of the ongoing definition of loop, Google and edX announced that they will develop software for the loop, and not only that, the idea is to spur development of so-called, that's so-called from the so-called massive open online courses building with EdX's president called Float to become, quote, a YouTube for MOOCs, which is everything that an original MOOC is in this moment, right? You think about we're going back to the star model, and if you sign up, the star model is not inappropriately named. Where we have the one big thing at the center, Google EdX Plus, and they will distribute it and dispense their wisdom from the best thinkers in the world to you. And that's probably what it would look like. So, my take is that this is a defensive reaction. And it's a defensive reaction because they're afraid that MOOCs would be something that doesn't resemble being, something that looks more like how it sounds. I put that in because Google, of course, just recently killed their RSS reader. This business of, this chat, app channel, and grassroots, all of this stuff that I built, for the connectedness MOOCs that we built, are built like RSS. They're built like one of these nice distributed networks where people connect to each other rather than follow a single solid thing. Google and EdX are afraid that MOOCs will be something created by the learners themselves, for themselves, as opposed to what they want to offer, things pulled by publishers to be sold to people as consumers. That's why they make announcements like this. And it's like the Yankee saying, look, this kind of career is mine. Go away. That's basically what they want. Because they've built it, right? It's the classic MIT traditional announcing something so that nobody else would do it and give them some space to do it and have it still there for the service. They I'm basically coverage, I don't know if I have any sense of asking, but the coverage of milk in the media, and we run them through content analyzers, graph to graph, and he says, you see anything but open in there. Open is the first thing we need. And even this concept, this nuanced concept of open, as interactive and engaged in the reach of Winston Smith and all of that, this concept of open has been reduced to a simple and sterile depiction of two senses of free. Free as in Uber and free as in Uber. That's the only way we seem to be able to understand open these days. And that's almost the only way we seem to be able to understand student engagement. So we have the failure of the week. And it's been in all the papers, right? And the failure of MOOCs looks like this. Stephen justifies his use of off-chat MOOCs, willing to keynote asserting it is a better experience. That's not such a good idea, too. Well, okay, but here it is. It's a better experience for me. So, yeah, I mean, there's no MOOCs. That is a really good comment. I love the subtlety in that one. We talk about the beautiful things we've been hearing of MOOCs and not interactive and not personal. And they sit back and they like, what do they call that? They call that the leaning back view. And it's also the concept in the website design, the leaning back view. The idea is the design of the website, the person in the chair isn't forward and interacting, they're leaning back. And that was the sweet spot they were aiming for, the leaning back view. Oh, okay, that's somebody who must have already started. I don't know how to do it. Okay, we're good. For those of you who can't read it, it's work. John Colton. It's interesting, right? With the back chair, these threaded Twitter discussions make a much less sense, right? If you just come back with it, no, that's Facebook. It's completely old context here. That's my experience of Twitter. I have a filter in there, it's supposed to screen out all the retweets. So John Clayton talks about the original model in student engagement, the original model of online learning as the deficit model approach. So you are laughing. And I will bring you up to speed. It is, yes, essentially a broadcast model. And the contrast, again, is the empowerment model based on learner reflection and decision making on what they want to learn. And this is how the MOOCs that we created are so very different from the MOOCs that EdX and the university created. But it's interesting, he says, sorry we want to do this, but then we actually get into practice and we never make this actually happen. Why the MOOCs fail? Why do they all fail? Why is it such a horrible, horrible experience? Well, because they're courses. And we probably never should have done courses in the first place. Although, having a Skype date, having an end date, and a topic of discussion was really convenient. But really, we probably never should have done in the course of practice for home. Because a course is something very formal, and the kind of environment we're trying to create is something that is essentially informal. Now, there are different ways of getting at this. This is, this via J. Cross. I'll tell you, this video is a 2-in-1. So often we try to define things according to what mold, according to a few other functional nature. But I think there's different ways of defining things. And I think formal learning, and this isn't me, I think this from something, just to get together what's on the list of the Jewish class here, is dedicated to obtaining a base of knowledge. And this learning just in case, so I'm sure you've all heard at some point or another. Informal, by contrast, is typically directed at the completion of some sort of task or activity, as opposed to completion of the learning. You see the distinction there, right? So, formal learning, you read a book cover to cover, you learn a lot about passages. Informal learning, you look at minor joints. No, I just told you, again. Informal learning, you look at motor joints because you're going to a bookshop and you want to do it better than I do. That's our culture, but great bookshops. Go to a merchant and clean carefully. I got my book insurance, I'm not going to. Okay. Here's what we see as MOOCs, properly so called, where a whole bunch of people join in at the front. Anyway, and almost nobody graduates at the end, and people look at this and say, failure, horrible. See, one interesting person, we're only one of them went from all school. You know, this little chart thing? I can change the time. And you can jump to learning models and look at their tweets and make fun of them. They can't do that here. And then this is from Phil Hill. And as Terry Anderson says, and then they'll show the same thing, only not so formally, and probably not so well, it may be best to conceptualize MOOCs as learning resources, which is in a library, that learners can use in very many different ways, with equally diverse, learning outcomes. And that's what we want to make to do, except not like learning results like books on a shelf, but learning resources like building a bookshelf or whatever, whatever you want to do. Everybody has a different objective. And it's the sort of thing where you go, you look in the book, you browse for a few minutes, you go, well, that's fine, it's not a problem. I'm going to say something else. I'm not even going to touch that because I don't want to send you on some digression to go for the time. Here's an example of actual content. This is a newspaper. It's an online newspaper, but you know, it's a design. It's a pretty typical form of design. You put, you scroll through it, you might go to a section like sports or opinion or entertainment. You click on the articles that are interesting to you, and you would know the rest. Nobody would consider this newspaper a failure if you did not, quote-unquote, finish it. Nobody finished it. Well, maybe somebody does. I used to do that. I don't know what you mean. You do that same advertising enough times, you know it. But, you know, we don't consider a paper a failure if nobody finishes it. We don't even consider a failure if a person only reads one or two articles and then crosses it and passes it in his own book. What makes a newspaper effective, successful, is the impact it has in society at large. It's not how someone uses the newspaper, it's whether the newspaper acted as an agent of change. I don't use this newspaper in particular, because it's mine, and it's built using exactly the same software I used to create links. The software to create MOOCs is the same thing is the software between an online newspaper. This newspaper is designed in such a way that any person in our community can write in their own blog or on Twitter, or you can't see the blog, or whatever, and it shows up in the newspaper. The newspaper created by a community for a community. So, this gives you a model of learning where learning is not organized by the teacher, it's organized by society. You may have seen this, the illumination of birds, where individuals make decisions for themselves. The kind of learning you see in this kind of organization is what is called emergent learning. It's the patterns that emerge that can be seen or recognized out of the interaction that takes place between the participants. This is a classic clustering kind of pattern. You can see the clustering, you can see the segmentation, and there are algorithms that allow you to detect some in a network. Roy Williams and Jimmy McNeish describe emergence as plotted conferences or plotted different courses and things. The emergence, that sweet spot, that nice bit of connectivity can be found. And then in the center, the prescribed moment of the authoritarian, and then on the outside, the chaos of everybody connected or nobody connected. And we took the liberty of doing one of this conference. And then there's strong authoritarian. And here's how the different threads of this talk map together. The idea of connectivity going from the circle star shape to the sweet spot of emergent moment to Life on the board. Almost there. We're in the home stretch. Because, as many of us said, the web is the most successful information architecture in history. And it's built successful precisely because it has these kind of model properties. It has hit that sweet spot. And the way it has that sweet spot is the stuckiness of it, the randomness of it, the quirkiness of it, but also the openness of it, the freedomness of it, and indeed even the universalness of it. Close the side of the magic perfect in the service. Why do the new forms fail? Because they're centralized. It's a case of 1,000 voices in a single room. Too many people connected to too many people. Why is online learning sometimes bad? Because it's too decentralized. There aren't enough connections. People think that they should connect only with the teacher. I've got a couple of slides here about the experiences in the conference. And the one that really stood out to me was the statement that the style we adopt as tutors and facilitators shapes the tone of student process. And this is the model of interactivity of participation in one of these distributed networks. It's not a personalized thing where you take something central and shape it for the student. It's something where our role as an instructor is to model and demonstrate. As I'm trying to model and demonstrate pace. Sharing our experiences as opposed to describing and explaining and telling people. The learning environment that we've tried to develop is one where students exercise choice, develop identity, and exercise creativity within this area. But you notice the creativity occurs after and outside the learning environment. Success in the MOOC can only be observed outside the MOOC, just as success in the newspaper can only be observed outside the newspaper. The emergent knowledge that is created in the MOOC, we see that reflected through society, and that's what makes the MOOC successful. The sharing of the experience is what's known. all cultures of learning are what we do, what we model, what we share, and what we feel. And of course, the obligatory Robin Hood show.